Support for the Exchange Podcast comes from you, our sustaining members, and from New Hampshire School Administrators Association, representing school superintendents and administrators, championing the education of children in our state every day since 1941. In today's ever-changing world, public education matters, and so does its leaders. Online at nhsaa.org.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, in for Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. Senator Bernie Sanders has won the first three primary contests, having won the Nevada caucuses over the weekend, but the rest of the field has not yet given up hope, and with both South Carolina's primary and Super Tuesday's elections around the corner, there is more to discuss before the Democrats nominate someone to take on President Donald Trump in the general election. In this hour, a look back at Nevada and last week's debate, and a look forward to what's to come for Democrats as voters inch closer to choosing a nominee. If you have questions or comments, send us an email. exchange@nhpr.org, or post on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, that's all one word, or give us a call. We'd love to hear from you. The number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. And joining us this hour, Chris Galderi, assistant professor in the Department of Politics at St. Anselm College. Chris, thank you very much for being here.
Glad to be here, Peter.
And we'll have more guests later in the program to lend their voice to the conversation, but we'll start with Chris. And let's start with the debate. The debate last week in Las Vegas, shortly before the Nevada caucuses, before we get into what was said, what do you think? How important is one debate right before an election in that same state?
Debates can really matter in primary elections, especially when you have a large field of candidates like the Democrats still do, because you don't have necessarily huge policy differences between candidates the way you do in a general election. You don't have the benefit of party identification to help voters make their decision because you have a group of people from the same party competing. So debate performances for people who decide late, and lots of people decide late in these primary contests, really can make a big difference.
Mm-hmm. And so let's talk particulars about this debate. What was your overall takeaway?
Well, I think the biggest headline probably was the amount of attacks directed at former New York City Mayor Mike Bloomberg. He had had a very good run in the weeks since Iowa by keeping the Super Tuesday field to himself, right? He's been mostly on the air in Super Tuesday states where there are not a lot of other candidates running or campaigning yet. And had slowly been moving up in the polls. And I think a lot of folks were looking at him and wondering, like, how much of a factor is he going to be in this election contest? And I think you had in that debate the on-the-air candidacy of Bloomberg sort of colliding with the reality of Bloomberg, which is that he is, you know, whatever you might think of him as a former mayor or as a candidate, he's rusty. He was someone who has not been in a debate since, I think, 2009, last time he ran for re-election as mayor, on a stage with a half dozen people who have been debating each other for the better part of a year now. So it wasn't surprising to me that he seemed a bit, didn't have quite as fancy footwork as the folks who have been debating each other this whole cycle.
And you can buy debate practice, which is surprising that he maybe if he did that, maybe not enough debate practice?
Could be. You can buy it, but you don't necessarily like it. He was never somebody who was a, fantastic debater. A lot of folks have said there are sort of two Bloombergs. There's the smart technocrat, and then there's the sort of peevish, kind of boring guy, and I think we saw which one of them showed up for the debate last week.
Well, let's hear a little bit of it. Senator Bernie Sanders singled out Mike Bloomberg both for past practices as a mayor and for his wealth.
In order to beat Donald Trump, we're going to need the largest voter turnout in the history of the United States. Mr. Bloomberg had policies in New York City of stop and frisk, which went after African-American and Latino people in an outrageous way. That is not a way you're going to grow voter turnout. What our movement is about is bringing working-class people together, black and white and Latino, Native American, Asian American, around an agenda that works for all of us and not just the billionaire class.
So Senator Bernie Sanders, they're going on the attack Mayor Michael Bloomberg. Two issues there I want to talk about separately. The first is specific to Bloomberg. Stop and frisk. How much of a liability is that for him?
I think it's potentially a big one. As Senator Sanders said, this is a policy that really did seem to disproportionately affect African-American and non-white citizens in New York City. And the Democratic primaries, first in Nevada, now in South Carolina upcoming, and then Super Tuesday, are moving away from the very white states of Iowa and New Hampshire into states that have much more diverse electorates. And I think if you were going into a state like South Carolina or after South Carolina, in Super Tuesday, you have states like Virginia, Texas, California, very diverse states. That's not necessarily a policy you want people to associate with you. And I think it's tough for Bloomberg to distance himself from that. And he said that, oh, gosh, it got out of hand. But that makes it sound like it was its own thing rather than a policy that he implemented.
And just to be clear, Bloomberg was not on the ballot in Nevada.
That's right.
He was not on the ballot. That's why he didn't get any results from Nevada.
Right. He wasn't on the ballot in Nevada, and he won't be in South Carolina. He doesn't appear on a ballot until Super Tuesday.
That's where he's been throwing most of his money towards Super Tuesday states. During that debate, he did respond. Mayor Bloomberg did respond to Bernie Sanders and had this to say.
I don't think there's any chance of the senator beating President Trump. You don't start out by saying, I've got 160 million people. I'm going to take away the insurance plan that they love. That's just not a ways that you go and start building the coalition that the Sanders camp thinks that they can do. I don't think there's any chance whatsoever. And if he goes and is the candidate, we will have Donald Trump for another 4 years, and we can't stand that.
This is not a view held uniquely by Bloomberg and his supporters, that the policies of Bernie Sanders may be a liability for him, according to some.
That's right. And you've heard this from Joe Biden saying, well, how are you going to pay for it? You've heard it from other candidates like Mayor Buttigieg saying, Medicare for all who want it would be great, but you don't want to force everybody into a Medicare option and that sort of thing. And I think there's some validity to that. Even if you were to have a Sanders administration, his ability to pass a health care plan would be limited by whoever the most conservative Democrat in the Senate was. And that's likely to be somebody like Joe Manchin of West Virginia or Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona. And they seem like unlikely candidates to cast votes for a full-on Medicare for all type plan on day one of a Sanders administration. I think this is an attack that you can expect to hear continuing throughout the primaries and if Sanders is the nominee into the general election.
Mm-hmm. And so he was the clear winner. Bernie Sanders was the clear winner out of Nevada. He's the delegate leader, although there haven't been many delegates allocated yet. So what do you make of his momentum? Is this going to carry forward?
It might. Clearly, he's in a better position than any of his rivals at this point. Clear winner in Nevada, narrow winner in New Hampshire. Iowa is, depending on how you look at it, it was him or Buttigieg. A win is a win is a win. And this was his first big win of the cycle. That said, it struck me listening to his comment earlier that you played talking about how we would win by building a movement, raising voter turnout and all the rest of it. And that hasn't really quite happened yet so far. You haven't seen the sorts of massive turnout spikes that you would expect from somebody who was leading a mass movement that was going to just totally transform a political party or the country's politics. You're seeing, fairly modest turnout boosts from 2016, from 2008, that are more consistent just with growing populations, or in the case of Nevada, they added about a week's worth of early voting before caucus day. You're not seeing the sort of, youth quake turnout surge that you might have expected just based on the rhetoric from Sanders and his campaign all throughout this race.
Mm-hmm. And we got a note from someone who said we shouldn't say that Bernie won the first three. Not true. Pete Buttigieg won Iowa. You just said that there's a little bit of a confusion over Iowa. Why is that?
It's because of Iowa's a caucus state.
Yeah.
What that means is it's not a direct question of who got the most votes. It's a question of allocation and distribution, where your votes were and that sort of thing. So I believe Mayor Buttigieg came out of Iowa with more delegates, although the Sanders campaign maintains that they have received more support from individual caucus goers in Iowa. But again, when you're trying to figure, especially trying to figure out the Iowa caucus, you get into all sorts of complicated issues of, well, where is your support and how many delegates were in this precinct versus that precinct? And that's part of the reason we're not quite sure exactly who's ahead and who's not in Iowa.
Thank you for clearing that up. We get this comment also from Christopher in Manchester, who says the commentariat class was tripping over themselves lauding Liz Warren after the debate. Didn't seem to help her in the caucus, though. Is her day in the sun done? That's from Christopher in Manchester.
That's a good question. I think part of what hurt Elizabeth Warren is that early voting that Nevada had. One of the issues with caucuses is that they are difficult to attend. They require, you know, fairly lengthy commitment. If you have to work during caucus time, you can't go. It's not like voting where you carve a half hour out of your day or an hour out of your day and you go vote at your convenience and come home and do it. So one issue to address that in Nevada was to add days of early voting. The problem with early voting is if something changes, like a really good debate performance, you've already cast your vote. You can't go back and change that. There's some evidence, I believe, that Warren did much better amongst folks who cast their ballots on Friday at the caucus than folks who did an early caucus vote. So there may have been some effect from the debate. She had what a lot of people thought was a very strong debate performance. I don't know that that's going to help her in South Carolina, but she seems to be committed to staying in through Super Tuesday. You know, she had a big rally in Denver over the weekend and doesn't seem to show any signs of wanting to drop out of the race yet.
I want to hear a little bit of Elizabeth Warren from that debate. She really came out swinging against New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg. Let's hear what she had to say to him.
I'd like to talk about who we're running against. A billionaire who calls women fat broads and horse-faced lesbians. And no, I'm not talking about Donald Trump. I'm talking about Mayor Bloomberg. Democrats are not going to win if we have a nominee who has a history of hiding his tax returns, of harassing women, and of supporting racist policies like redlining and stop and frisk. Look, I'll support whoever the Democratic nominee is. But understand this, Democrats take a huge risk if we just substitute one arrogant billionaire for another. This country has worked for the rich for a long time and left everyone else in the dirt.
So Elizabeth Warren not mincing words there. And I guess that's why, as Christopher was pointing out, people really seem to admire what she did at the debate.
Yeah. And I think if you're Elizabeth Warren, I mean, there's no greater gift you can be given on a debate stage than Mike Bloomberg, because, you know, he just plays to, and this is the case for Bernie Sanders as well, it just plays to everything that she's been talking about her entire campaign. And then the fact that, well, he didn't do the early states, he's strategically focusing on Super Tuesday and going up on the air with hundreds of millions of dollars worth of ads. I think, you know, for Elizabeth Warren, that was just such a slow, low softball underhand pitch that she just couldn't resist hitting it very, very hard.
Well, listeners, let us know what you think of both this debate and the results of the Nevada caucuses. If your chosen candidate has dropped out since New Hampshire's primary, where's your support now? And is there a Democrat that you would absolutely refuse to vote for in the general? Let us know. The number is 1-800-892-6477. You can also email exchange@nhpr.org. We'll bring your voice into the conversation that way. And we get this note from Johnny. Johnny writes, according to the Nevada caucus rules, a candidate must capture 15% of the votes in order to receive delegates. As of this morning, with 96% of the districts reported, Pete Buttigieg has just over 13%. Why is it being reported that he will receive two delegates coming out of Nevada? It might depend on where you're looking right now. I'm not sure. Maybe this is a fast-moving calculation and not quite final yet, but what I have is that Pete Buttigieg has one delegate. He's in third behind Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden. But what do you think, Chris?
Well, it's not necessarily just 15% statewide. It has to do with where delegates are allocated. So there are statewide delegates. There are delegates that are allocated at the congressional district level. I believe that the states also get additional delegates depending on how they voted in the last election, how many Democratic office holders they have, and so on. So it may be that while Mayor Buttigieg fell short of 15% statewide, that there were individual precincts or districts where he did cross that threshold and was able to pick up a delegate or two.
Mm-hmm. I want to bring another voice into the conversation now. Let's talk to James Pindle. He's a political reporter for the Boston Globe. James, thank you very much for being on the line with us. Really appreciate it.
Of course.
We've been speaking getting down into the weeds a little bit about the debate and the following Nevada caucuses. I want to get your general sense. What do you make of the results coming out of Nevada?
Look, this is quickly becoming a race for Bernie Sanders to lose. Nevada was a pivotal contest in 2016. We don't talk about it enough. It was the moment that Hillary Clinton sort of righted the ship after losing to Bernie Sanders in New Hampshire by 22 points. And I think that Nevada, when we look back, will also be the most pivotal contest as well. When you look back and say, oh, right, this is the moment where Bernie Sanders began to have significant momentum, where it became to be very obvious where and how he would be the Democratic nominee. And so we're now experiencing a moment from some in the Democratic establishment, a freakout. Some of those who believe that Sanders is too far left to win a general election. I could counterpoint that. And then Bernie Sanders would counterpoint that as well. But it may be almost too late to stop the momentum. We're heading into South Carolina on Saturday. And I think that South Carolina has been entirely overblown this entire cycle. I understand the arguments. The first time a real large African-American electorate gets to weigh in. And it's in the South, and there's electability. And I understand all that. But there's a counterpoint to that, which is just simply process. It's not that they're wrong. It's process. South Carolina is 3 days before Super Tuesday. Joe Biden had a good performance, I guess, in Nevada, coming in second place. That's good for him, given where he started out in Iowa and in New Hampshire. But he also lost by 30 points, let's be honest. And if he does well in South Carolina, and that's an if, he is tanking while Bernie Sanders is surging there. All right, he doesn't have enough time to raise the money to cut the ads and to buy the ads before Super Tuesday, where I do believe Bernie Sanders is just going to swamp everyone, including in the two largest states in the country of California and Texas.
I see. Chris, your thoughts on what James had to say.
Well, I don't know that James is wrong necessarily. I do think there's a possibility that, you know, if Biden does surprise everybody with a big win in South Carolina, or that some of these other candidates who are sticking around, drop out after a poor showing in South Carolina. I do think there's something to the idea that, you know, once you get a certain head of steam in these sorts of things, it's tough to stop someone. On the other hand, I look at things like, you know, Bernie Sanders' comments to 60 Minutes over the weekend about, well, you know, Castro's Cuba did have a great literacy program, that sort of thing. And I watched the reaction of Democrats to that, and I wonder if that's
Can you say what that was?
It was during an interview with on 60 Minutes, and it was something to the effect of saying that while Sanders condemned, you know, the authoritarian aspects of Castro's regime, it's not that everything that happened under Castro was bad. For instance, when he came to power, they started a literacy program. And that's the sort of, you know, incredibly tone-deaf sort of thing that makes me wonder if there might not be more impetus for a, you know, stop Sanders movement or a for everyone to just say, whoa, wait a second, maybe Joe Biden's not so bad after all sort of thing. I don't know. I don't think that, I would rather be Bernie Sanders than any of the other candidates in the field right now in terms of winning the nomination. But I look at that sort of self-imposed injury and, you know, wonder if that will affect the calculations of the other candidates.
I see. Let's talk to Fred in Nashua. Fred, thanks for calling. What's your question or comment?
Hello. Yeah, can you hear me?
Sure can. You're on the air.
Okay. Well, I just want to comment about Bernie. I've often written about how I don't like Trump and he should be impeached, but given a choice between Trump and Bernie, I'd vote for Trump anytime.
Why is that?
I think Bernie would destroy our democracy as it is. He would do everlasting damage. And all you have to do is look at, for instance, the Soviet Revolution in 1917, when they got rid of all the rich, put them on the guillotines. You could have an absolute communist socialist taking over. They want everything for free.
I see. Okay. Thank you very much, Fred. Appreciate your call. So that might have been getting at what you were talking about. There's some people who are just really, really worried about what Bernie Sanders wants to do. Yeah. Oh, sure. Sure. Go ahead, James.
I mean, this is never going to happen, the fear of him from Nashua. I mean, a lot of what Bernie Sanders is arguing for is never going to happen.
Which things do you think will never happen?
Well, look, Medicare for all. I mean, you know, he has been hammered on the fact that he has never spelled out exactly how he would pay for it. Meanwhile, Elizabeth Warren did and got slammed. Here's the truth. President Trump is not building a wall, so it doesn't matter if he says Mexico is going to pay for it. Right now, Medicare for all has, like, basically no support among Democrats even in the Senate. It's not going to happen, so it doesn't matter exactly how you're going to pay for it. The idea that he's going to suddenly become president and is the caller mentioned, number one, is communist, which is not. But number two, that a lot of these, you know, free college is going to happen. It's not happening. Medicare for all, it's not happening. There's no trajectory. There's no political argument as to how these things are going to happen. We are having an intellectual conversation about ideology and about where you're coming from. Elizabeth Warren, by the way, her tact of how she's different than Bernie Sanders is that, one, she would get rid of a filibuster, which, I mean, that's where we're at here in terms of, like, an intellectual conversation. And second, that she would sign things like the USMCA, the new NAFTA, where he's against it because she says it's progress, and then she'll work for more progress. In terms of, like, big picture free college, that, wiping out student debt, when he does his plan is to somehow tax Wall Street speculation, there's not 60 votes in the Senate for that. There's not even the votes of Democrats for that. So while I do agree with the caller from Nashua that President Trump is absolutely going to use these lines and try to use it against Bernie Sanders as any politician would, the idea that if he becomes president, we're going to have people headed to the guillotines is ridiculous.
And Chris, do you agree? Is Medicare for all, free college for everybody not going to happen?
I mean, I think there are tremendous obstacles to doing that sort of thing. As James said, you know, the votes just aren't going to be there in the Senate for it. So then the question becomes, well, how do you climb down from those positions? You know, how does a President Sanders, for the sake of argument, does he introduce Medicare for all and take a loss? Does he pass some sort of small ball reform and call it a win? Do his supporters stand by him after that? One of the kind of remarkable things about the Sanders movement in 2016 and 2020 has been the strength and the fervor of his online supporters. Do those folks stick with him if he has to act like a normal politician and say, well, we didn't get half a loaf, but we got a third of a loaf, and that's pretty good. I'm going to sign it and move on, as, for instance, Senator Warren has said she would have done with the trade agreement. And I think that's really an open question as to whether, Bernie Sanders supporters would stick with him if he had to act like a normal politician.
I think Bernie Sanders is being serious. He's not lying. He definitely wants these plans. Mm-hmm. He definitely thinks they're a good idea. He's being very serious about it. I just, politically speaking, to take it to the next level, that people are going to head to the guillotines, that we're going to have a communist country. It's not going to happen.
Let's talk to Taylor in Nashua. Taylor, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question or comment?
So I heard you asking earlier if there was a Democrat candidate that I wouldn't vote for if they won the nomination. And going back to 2016, I primary voted for Bernie and reluctantly voted for Hillary in the 2016 election. But I don't know if I could do the same for someone like Bloomberg, who represents literally all of the same things that I don't like about Trump and can't stand, and just in a kind of more acceptable packaging to some establishment Democrats. I don't know if I could vote for that person.
Thank you, Taylor. Really appreciate your comment. I don't think we've heard from you yet, James, on Mike Bloomberg's candidacy. What do you make of his candidacy?
Yeah, it's a very interesting comment from Taylor, because what's happening here is that it's not is that those who are supporting Bloomberg, and his numbers are absolutely going up, it's not because they think he's right on issues. It's because they're already compromising. So when we have new issues, for example, that he didn't handle sexual harassment claims at his company very well, if we want to bring up again stop and frisk, totally legit issues, or his support for George W. Bush for president in the past, things that do not go well with the Democratic base. The Democratic base, those who are already with Bloomberg, say, I know, and I don't agree with it. However, they think he's the only one left who can actually defeat Trump for various reasons, and a big reason is his checkbook. Remember, Oprah is worth $2.8 billion. That's a lot of money. He's worth $64.
$64 billion, yeah.
And so folks have already compromised, but this is where the debate, on particularly the debate tomorrow night, really matters, because it's not like, oh, I gotcha on a political issue where you're flip-flopping. It's if you're really a bad debater, then maybe you aren't the person we should put up against Trump. This is the argument among the Democratic base. So, his feelings about Bloomberg is something I certainly hear all the time, that it could pretty much go for everyone except for maybe Bernie, and other people are saying, well, maybe not Bloomberg. Obviously, Sanders had his own problem answering that question on 60 Minutes last night, saying that, yes, Bloomberg would have some flaws. But the interesting thing about him is, this, again, it's not like a normal candidate where you're like, oh, well, I didn't realize that person was horrible on my issue. It's like, I just didn't know that person was so horrible going on a debate stage.
We are talking about the presidential nomination process, which has left New Hampshire but is still underway in other key states. Ahead of Super Tuesday, what are you worried about? What are you watching for? Email us. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Coming up, we're going to talk a little bit about South Carolina and what's to come. This is The Exchange. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back. This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, filling in today for Laura Kanoy. And right now, we are looking at the presidential nomination process. We're looking forward to South Carolina, which holds its primary election on Saturday, February 29th. And shortly after that, we've got states on Super Tuesday, early March. Joining us for the conversation today, Chris Galdieri, assistant professor in the Department of Politics at St. Anselm College, and James Pindle, political reporter for the Boston Globe. And on the line with us now is Mayan Schechter, State House reporter for the State Newspaper in Columbia, South Carolina. She's going to give us the lay of the land down south. Mayan, thank you very much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
So the primary is coming up this Saturday. Remind us why South Carolina is such a key state for Democrats.
Sure. I mean, South Carolina is the first Southern primary. This is the real test for candidates to see how they fare among African-American voters. The South Carolina Democratic Party's primary voting block is two-thirds to more than 60% African-American. This is the best test for candidates, especially as they move into Super Tuesday states, which are more reflective of South Carolina's demographic. We are very different from Iowa, New Hampshire, where the majority of voters there are white, and we're also different from the state of Nevada, where the majority of the Democratic voters there are Hispanic and Latino. So this certainly is a really important state for these candidates who are hoping to get some momentum heading into those more diverse Super Tuesday states.
Mm-hmm. And who is doing well in South Carolina right now?
Well, if you ask each individual candidate, I'm sure they'll tell you them.
They are, yeah.
But most Democrats will tell you that former Vice President Joe Biden is still considered the favorite to win the primary on Saturday. But certainly with disappointing losses for Biden in Iowa, New Hampshire, and coming even in second in Nevada, That's hurt him a little bit. And it's shown in the polls here, especially as Senator Bernie Sanders has done well in those early phases and is the front runner in national polls. Last week, a Winthrop poll that came out showed Biden with 24% support among likely Democratic voters here, and Sanders was not that far behind at 19%. That margin has steadily been shrinking, and California businessman Tom Steyer has been holding third, which is very unusual compared with some of the other early voting states and national polling as well. He's been holding third at around 15-18%. So it's certainly a much more competitive race here on the ground than I would have said, you know, 5-6 months ago.
What is it about Tom Steyer that puts him in that position?
Well, first and foremost, he's obviously been able to spend a lot of money here on the ground. He has spent millions of dollars on digital and TV airwaves. He has spent money in black-owned media. He's been taking out full-page ads in college newspapers. And keep in mind, he has been on the airwaves here for longer than a year, way longer than any of the other candidates, especially because of his need to impeach or campaign that he started over a year and a half ago. But it's not just that. When you talk to voters on the ground, it's really that accessibility that Tom Steyer brings. I mean, Tom Steyer is unlike some of these other candidates who were, you know, had to sit in D.C. for a few weeks dealing with impeachment, or other candidates who have had to fly across the country doing fundraisers. He's in a unique position. So he certainly disrupted the race here, especially for someone like Biden, who hasn't been on the ground as much, who hasn't been spending as much money on airwaves as well. So it's been an interesting race so far.
And what would you make of folks like Pete Buttigieg and Amy Klobuchar? Where do they stand in South Carolina thus far?
They are pretty far down in the polls here. I mean, they do have a support system. Pete Buttigieg has been on the ground several times throughout the past year. He has come out with ads. He's got a pretty substantial staff here on the ground. But he and Klobuchar suffer from the same problem, and that is Black voter support. I mean, together they total about 5% support among Black voters. And that was always going to be a problem with them. I mean, when you have someone like Joe Biden in the race who has a long relationship with South Carolina, when you have someone like Bernie Sanders in the race who, of course, ran in 2016 and started building that foundation here, it's going to be tough for either one of them. Klobuchar is interesting. She hasn't really invested a whole lot in South Carolina. She visited a few times over the past year. She just started staffing up here like a week out until the primary. So this was always going to be a struggle for them, and it'll be interesting to see what happens past Saturday.
Okay. Pete Buttigieg, former Indiana, South Bend, Indiana mayor, sat down with the state earlier in February, and I do want to play a little bit of his voice.
I'm also talking to a lot of voters, especially Black voters who are deeply pragmatic, want somebody who is going to win, recognizing the urgency of defeating Donald Trump. And so I'm also very mindful that part of how you establish credibility with voters here is to do well in the very first contests in Iowa and New Hampshire. And there are, I think, a lot of voters who won't really be unlocked for us until we've been able to have that show of strength, as I believe we will.
So Pete Buttigieg hoping to unlock South Carolina voters based on his performance in earlier states. How true does that ring for you, Mayan? Can South Carolina voters be unlocked by shows of support in other states?
You know, there's a lot of comparisons that happened between 2020 and 2008, and this is just a very, very different election. We have very, very different candidates running for office. When I've talked to voters, they don't particularly, I mean, they're interested in what is going on in Iowa, New Hampshire, and Nevada, but frankly, they're very well aware that the demographics are just so different. And it doesn't hurt to repeat that when, you know, your lawmakers are going on cable television and they're talking about that all the time, about how different our voting demographics here are anywhere else. This is a different election. And so most of the time, I mean, yes, there are undecided voters who are still kind of choosing between a couple of candidates. But again, I haven't been sold that in this particular contest, that what has happened in the other voting states is having a huge impact. Now, if you're Bernie Sanders, who has been doing very, very well, and you're someone that has been on the fence of whether to support Bernie Sanders, sure, he looks like a very viable candidate right now heading into South Carolina.
Mm-hmm. You've written about how this primary could impact local elections down the ballot and how a lot of politicians in the Democratic Party are thinking carefully about their endorsements. So can you tell us what they're worried about?
They're worried about Bernie Sanders. Mm-hmm. They're worried about this self-identification as a Democratic socialist. I mean, there is a lot of concern on the ground from Democrats here who have run local races, who have run congressional races, about what the impact could be of having Bernie Sanders at the top of the ticket. I think it's why you've seen Joe Biden, Pete Buttigieg recently raise this issue of how he identifies himself within the Democratic Party. And I'm sure you'll certainly hear that repeated on the debate stage on Tuesday night in Charleston. It's a big issue. South Carolina, for the first time, has several Democrats running in increasingly competitive seats. And the one in particular that most people point to is in the first district. That's Joe Cunningham's district. Joe Cunningham is a moderate a Democrat who won a seat held by Republicans for a very long time. It was held by Mark Sanford, the former governor of South Carolina, for several years. And that is a seat that Democrats are very worried about giving up. But it's not even just that. Jamie Harrison, the former chairman of the South Carolina Democratic Party, is hoping to unseat longtime Republican Senator Lindsey Graham. We have another Democrat running in the 2nd District. I mean, it goes down and down and down, and mm-hmm. it even goes all the way into state house seats. We have a couple of state house seats that are competitive, especially in that Charleston 1st District area, that Democrats within the party are concerned about. Congressman Jim Clyburn also expressed that concern in sit-downs with reporters, including myself, yesterday. So this is going to be an issue that I think we're going to keep hearing about, especially heading into Tuesday, or tomorrow's debate, but especially heading into the primary. I would not be shocked to hear candidates, particularly Biden, knocking this issue over and over.
I see. And what is the prediction, if there is a prediction, about how turnout's going to be in South Carolina?
Ooh, it's so hard to tell.
Anybody's guess at this point?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. The majority of our Democratic Party electorate, like I said, is African American. They're older voters, and these older voters tend to show up and they tend to vote. We're still kind of looking at the numbers of how many people wound up registering who kind of fit into that college age voting range. I think there's a good chance that turnout could be strong here, but it's up in the air at this point. I would hate to speculate.
Well, Mayan Schachter, State House reporter for the State newspaper in Columbia, South Carolina, thank you very much for taking some time with us this morning. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Listeners, we're talking about the Democratic primary with a few folks who have been following this closely. South Carolina votes on Saturday. Then Tuesday, March 3rd is Super Tuesday. What's on your mind about these candidates and the ideas they espouse? How important is the elusive concept of electability to you? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And I want to turn back to James Pindle, political reporter for the Boston Globe, and Chris Galderi of St. Anselm College. So going into South Carolina, what will you be looking for? We'll start with you, Chris.
I'll be looking for whether Joe Biden can finally put a win on the board. And if he does, by what sort of margin? And if he doesn't, then who beats him? If Bernie Sanders wins South Carolina, then I think, I don't want to say it's over, but it's probably pretty close to over. On the other hand, if Biden does well, maybe things change going forward.
Mm-hmm. And how about you, James? What do you think?
I don't know who's actually competing in South Carolina. I think all week we're going to be watching this. Again, the calendar is 3 days. South Carolina is 3 days before Super Tuesday. If I am a candidate who really needs to raise some money or am nervous about how I'm going to continue, if I am Pete Buttigieg, who just never really caught on with people of color, I might be taking my time heading out to South Carolina, do a couple more fundraising stops in California, hit a couple more congressional districts, then make my way to Texas, then make my way to Arkansas and to Alabama and these other Super Tuesday states before I even made it to South Carolina. But Chris is right. The top line is all that matters here. I mean, does Biden win? If so, by how much? And if Bernie Sanders somehow pulls off a win, and remember, he is the one with the momentum, then it is obviously going to be game over. The X factor, I think, in South Carolina is Elizabeth Warren. The most important moment, by the way, Elizabeth Warren is the one person who a lot of particularly African Americans have said is really understands their issues lately in terms of anyone on that stage. They're kind of concerned about the role that Biden is playing in this race. So I think she's an X factor. If she catches on, she clearly hurts Bernie Sanders and then helps Biden win. But I think the most important thing in this South Carolina week is going to be this debate tomorrow night, because it can set the stage for momentum going into Super Tuesday more than even the results in South Carolina.
Mm-hmm. James, you mentioned earlier that you don't believe that some of Senator Sanders' big policies, Medicare for all, free college for everyone, will ever get through. We got this comment from Linda, who says, the Bernie theory is that it will take people fighting for the things that they want in a democratic process to effect real change. So the fact that senators currently don't support things like Medicare for all doesn't mean that they might not come around if people stay actively involved. Does Linda have a point, James?
she absolutely has a point. This is Bernie Sanders' point. This is Elizabeth Warren's point, which is if you aren't even fighting for it, if you aren't even talking about it, if you aren't changing the trajectory of American politics, then you're certainly never going to happen. They're absolutely right. Look at where we're at on immigration and Donald Trump because of the way he talks about it. But nonetheless, the idea that on day one, this is going to happen, where we likely have a Republican Senate, and we need to explain how Democrats will even take the Senate, and then how after that you're ever going to get 60 votes in the Senate. For what, right now, I think this has only got like 14 co-sponsors, Medicare for All, for example. There's a lot. We're talking about a project, Medicare for All, if you really are into it, over the next course of a couple of decades. We're not talking about it in the next course of a couple of years.
Let's go to the phones and talk to Charlie in Laconia. Charlie, thanks very much for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you. Good morning. I have never recovered from 1972. First time I was able to vote, I thought we had a terrible president with Richard Nixon and a very good candidate with George McGovern, decorated Army Air Corps veteran, never called himself a socialist, but was painted as such, or a very left-leaning candidate. And you saw what happened. He lost every state in the country but one. And I'm scared to death that that could happen with Bernie Sanders.
Okay, so does that mean you are not voting for Bernie, or you're going to choose someone else?
No, I already voted in the primary for Joe Biden. That's who I'm hoping we have as our candidate. I just don't want Donald Trump, but I'm just scared to death that if Sanders gets elected, that's what we're going to be stuck with.
Well, Charlie, thanks very much for your call. Chris?
Well, I think one thing that should give Charlie some hope is the level of political polarization in the country today. I think as we saw in 2016, where lots of Republicans weren't really on board with Donald Trump, didn't like Donald Trump, and then on Election Day found themselves voting for Donald Trump, I think an awful lot of Democrats will do the same thing if Bernie Sanders is the nominee. I don't know that that will be enough to get him to 270 electoral votes, but my guess is he would probably, do respectably well, is so far as you can do that in a presidential election. But I don't think you're looking at the sort of blowout where somebody gets, 38% of the vote. I think this floor for a candidate in this environment is probably around 43-44% of the vote. So not a McGovern size.
Chris is right. And the thing that also, Charlie, you can have some solace in is that while I think that this nomination is for Bernie Sanders to lose, it's not like Bernie Sanders is going to absolutely have the majority of delegates on the first ballot in Milwaukee at the Democratic National Convention. In fact, where the debate is right now is how close does he need to get to be that 50% to not deny him the nomination? There's actually a very high-level conversation occurring among Democrats right now. If he is 45% of delegates, is that good enough? Is it 40? But a clear plurality, is that good enough? Because you don't want to blow up the party. Or because on that second ballot, superdelegates get to weigh in. And, of course, no one's pledged on any ballot, no matter what. Can they take the nomination away from Sanders? It could be a wild next couple of months. But as much as Bernie Sanders is the front runner right now for the Democratic nomination, it is not his right now.
Well, this is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we'll talk a little bit about election interference. Officials say Russia is attempting once again to influence U.S. elections. How concerned are you about that? Also, how responsible are candidates when their supporters behave badly? Email exchange at nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back.
From the seacoast to the Upper Valley, Monadnock to the Great North Woods, NHPR covers the stories that impact your community to help you stay connected to what's happening in every corner of the state. I'm Annie Ropeek, a reporter here at NHPR, and when you give $10 a month as a sustainer, you'll help support a vital resource that is statewide, regional, and deeply New Hampshire. Give today at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and we're talking about the race to become the Democratic presidential candidate who can take on President Trump. I'm here with Chris Galdieri, assistant professor in the Department of Politics at St. Anselm College, and James Pindle, political reporter for the Boston Globe. We're going to spend some time in this part of the program talking a little bit about Russian interference and election security, and we want to hear your thoughts on that if you have any. To what extent are you worried about it? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. We're also going to talk a little bit about supporters and their behavior and how responsible candidates are for the behavior, good and bad, of their supporters. Again, the phone number, 1-800-892-6477. So intelligence officials have concluded that Russia already is actively interfering in the U.S. presidential campaign. This is not news that I think will be terribly surprising if you followed what was happening in 2016. But James Pindle, I want to ask you, so how does this story influence the race at all? Does it help a candidate? Does it hurt a candidate? Does it hurt incumbent President Donald Trump? What do you think?
Well, let's be clear where we're at, what we know and what we don't know. Mm-hmm. What we know is that apparently our intelligence officials have said that Russia is trying, again, to influence the election, that A, they like Donald Trump either to win or to be the Republican nominee, and that they like Bernie Sanders to be the nominee. That's what they say. I obviously have not in those intelligence briefings myself. I don't know, but that's what we have learned. What we have not learned is, have they acted on any way of trying to interfere in these elections? We don't see anything on the ground. Yes, Facebook is a cesspool of fake news and everything else, but we haven't seen it demonstrated in a coordinated way that Russian bots are specifically, for example, helping Bernie Sanders or anyone else. But that's where we're at. We know that apparently that they are trying, but they could just be discussing it. I don't doubt that they aren't serious about it. But we haven't seen anything on the ground that say influenced the New Hampshire primary or something.
So when you say on the ground, you mean like they're not, as far as we know yet, hacking into election security systems, changing vote tallies. They're not doing that, but they may be engaged in misinformation
or
like they were 4 years ago.
We haven't even seen wide-scale disinformation ways that they've been trying to do things. They may be planning it. For all I know, they are doing it. We just have not seen any evidence laid out in front of us as to how they have been trying to influence the election. All we have right now, all we understand right now in terms of the news coverage of it, is that there is definitely an intent to do so.
Mm-hmm. And Chris, what do you make of the news that Russia is once again actively interfering?
Well, it's not terribly surprising. We know that they, you know, for instance, engaged in lots of misinformation and disinformation campaigning in 2016. So I think you can expect to see, lots more weird stuff on social media, Facebook groups that are designed to sort of inject ideas into the mainstream. And again, these things aren't really so much aimed at changing votes in the voting booth as their cast, so much as affecting people's attitudes towards candidates, trying to perpetuate narratives about what this candidate will do if they're elected versus what this other candidate will do if that's elected. Getting back to our caller earlier who was worried about guillotines, for instance, I think that's exactly the sort of thing that you might see propagated if you were, for instance, trying to use misinformation against a Sanders nomination and so on. I think in terms of the security of the electoral infrastructure, voting machines, registration lists, and that sort of thing, everybody should be very worried because very few of those things in the states are anywhere near as secure as they should be. And because of the way we conduct our elections, you're not dealing with one system that you can protect with one robust defense structure. You're dealing with 51 different structures in the states in Washington, D.C. that allocate varying levels of resources for that sort of thing. Some systems are much easier to get into than others. I think, it's really tough to conclude that we are doing enough to protect our elections from the prospect of outside interference.
Mm-hmm. So this is a story that's likely to continue as the campaigns progress. One other thing I wanted to talk about, one aspect we haven't really talked about yet, is the nature of a candidate's supporters. and their responsibility for their behavior. Most recently, Senator Sanders was criticized for allegedly having supporters who were very aggressive. These people are sometimes referred to as Bernie bros. Where does this argument, Chris, fit into the political discourse, this idea of candidates and their responsibility for their supporters' behavior?
Well, I think, you know, one of the things with the modern social media environment we live in is that you're aware of these things in a way that you wouldn't have been, you know, 20 years ago, right? You didn't know what Bush supporters were like or Gore supporters were like outside the ones in your immediate social circle. I think, you know, now it's possible for supporters of candidates to interact with each other online, sort of turn into echo chambers, feel like if you're not with us, you're against us, that sort of thing. And in the case of, you know, Bernie Sanders supporters, you're probably going to encounter a lot of triumphalism over the next couple of months if he does, in fact, wind up with the nomination.
What does that mean? You mean like we told you so? Should it happen four years ago?
And we did it. We've taken over the party. We're going to, you know, we're going to do, you know, Medicare for all and all the rest of it. And, you know, there's a degree to which that's earned. But I think that can be off-putting and alienating towards, you know, supporters of other candidates and that sort of thing. You know, to paraphrase Mayor Buttigieg, if you think of politics in terms of addition, I think that sort of thing makes it harder to expand your coalition or makes people a little less reluctant to consider themselves a supporter if that's what your image of a supporter is.
Mm-hmm. And James, what do you make of this idea, the candidates and their relationship with their supporters, some of whom may not behave above board?
Look, the other thing that's changed, Chris mentions we didn't know what supporters are doing, is that the supporters who are very rabid can do a lot more damage. We saw what these Bernie bros have done to the culinary union leaders, for example, many of them female, and how they've attacked them and harassed them. Look, the Bernie bro thing is absolutely real. It was also real from the Trump folks. At the same time, you can understand why they feel a little bit aggrieved, given how 2016 went down. How much is Bernie Sanders is responsible for their activism or negative ways they handle themselves? I mean, I don't know. He has condemned them. There's not much else he can do about it. Part of it's the age we're in, and I'm not sitting here throwing up our hands. If Buttigieg wants to claim that Sanders and his supporters are no better to the political discourse than Trump folks, that's a debate to be had, and certainly he'll try to use that debate for his own political points. But I don't know how much we can really ask of Bernie Sanders. What else do you want him to do? He's on the debate stage the last time, he flat out disavowed them, said they are not part of his movement or his revolution.
We got this note from Margaret in Concord, hearkening back to our conversation about Russian election interference just a moment ago. Margaret called in to say, and we just have a note from her, that Russia wants to help Bernie Sanders because Trump will beat him hands down. So seeing a little bit of political gamesmanship in what Russia is trying to do, allegedly trying to do. One final topic we should address before the end of the program, and this is the narrative thread that we keep seeing, the persistent belief by some that there is a mainstream both media bias against candidate fill in the blank and a Democratic National Committee bias in favor of one candidate versus the other. I want to get both of your opinions on this really quickly before we go. Chris, is this a narrative that needs debunking in your view?
I think so. I mean, if the Democratic National Committee or the Democratic establishment was trying to line up their support behind one candidate, they've done a terrible job of that. I mean, you had at one point or another, I think you had 26 or 27 different people running for the nomination, most of whom had absolutely no shot. You saw a host of very talented politicians with really interesting resumes and backgrounds go absolutely nowhere in the process last year, and all were dropped out by around, you know, January 1st, folks like Cory Booker and Kamala Harris and, you know, Jay Inslee and so on. And, you know, there's, you know, I'm trying to figure out who the beneficiary of this was. You know, at least in 2016, you could say clearly, you know, mainstream establishment Democrats, party leaders, whatever you want to call them, favored Clinton over Sanders. And you could, you know, point to, you know, 600 endorsements from superdelegates before a vote had been cast. But in 2020, I mean, the Democratic establishment has, you know, just has gone fishing or something.
Mm-hmm. And James, what do you think?
Yeah, I'd just reiterate, but Chris is exactly right. I mean, we are living in an age over the last three decades where institutions, whether they are political institutions in terms of parties or whether they're the media, sports figures, you can go churches, businesses, unions, you can go down the line. All these institutions matter less than they have mattered in the past. And the biggest proof you have to that is if institutions and parties matter, Donald Trump would never have won the Republican nomination, and Bernie Sanders would not be the front runner right now. While you can point to things that you think may be biased or you think they were trying to be rigged, they are clearly not successful.
Well, I want to thank you both for being on the program today. It's been really great to hear your insights. I think we have time really quickly for you to give some predictions for the debate that's coming up. We'll start with you, James.
Well, look, I think the biggest X factor, again, is can Elizabeth Warren pull off a performance like that again? If so, then she kind of changes the dynamic in South Carolina and going forward. At the same time, can Mike Bloomberg catch his sea legs here and actually pull off an okay performance that can inspire confidence for those who are more moderate and want to stop Sanders? And those are the two main dynamics to watch, I think, in this debate.
And Chris?
Yeah, I'm going to be watching to see if anybody manages to attack Bernie Sanders and attack him in a way that sticks. We saw Bloomberg try that with the thing about, you own three houses, and that kind of went over like a lead balloon. If someone is able to actually do some damage to Sanders, I think that might shake things up a little bit. But if history is any expectation, they'll all go after Mike Bloomberg again.
That's Chris Galdieri, assistant professor in the Department of Politics at St. Anselm College. Also, James Pindle, political reporter for the Boston Globe. Thank you both very much for being on the program today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks also to Mayan Schachter for joining us earlier in the show. She's from the state newspaper in Columbia, South Carolina. You can continue the conversation about this show online at nhpr.org and on our Facebook page. This is The Exchange on NHPR. The show's producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Michael Brindley is our program manager. Our regular theme music is composed by Bob Lord. The engineer is Dan Colgan. I'm Peter Biello, in for Laura Kanoy. Thank you very much for listening.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.